session number 9422, reel 12.
Mr. Harold Hayward, Reel 12. Could you continue your account just following your wounding?
Yes, well, somewhere at sunrise next morning, the stretcher bearers came and put me on the stretcher and carried me out on beyond one of the roads and where the RAMC had brought their horse-drawn ambulance against very badly pocked ground from shells. I did admire them for that. It was both that way and when I was in it. I was on, there were four places, two Germans down below, two English up above, and they were moaning like the very devil down there, and we were all on the top, which of course took all the swing, which I thought not much of. However, that took us back, the RMC, to the field hospital at something Suresong, I've forgotten the name now, and then from there down to the casualty clearing station, from there by train to Le Trépol, where I went into a Canadian base hospital. Well, I have shown you the shrapnel and a little bit of dressing. My wound was dressed every 4 hours, and I broke into a sweat every time I heard that ward door open. So the senior sister must have heard about it, and she came up 10 o'clock one night and said, "I want you to keep awake because I'm coming to do something about that place down in your privates." And she came in, and with one orderly on each limb, myself lying on the top of the bed, she got her tweezers and pulled this shrapnel out. Not nice at the time, but my goodness, I didn't have to have to think what I was about to go through when every 4 hours, otherwise they were, that when they put the dressing in, it turned this thing over in my testicles. Oh, I was pleased.
Were you satisfied with the medical treatment you received overall?
Entirely. Our own stretcher bearers were ourselves, 12 Gloucester men, you know, Bristol's own. And then, as I said, when we were down at Brace or some, they'd got a school, and the schoolyard was full of wounded chaps. The RAMC officer were walking along, and yes, no to their men. Either the man they thought was too far gone, it would be a waste of their time, or would last out, as I did, you know, to be operated on down at the base.
Did you actually have an operation while you were at Le Trépol, or was it just this?
Well, wasn't that an operation? No anaesthetic.
What happened next then? Where were you?
I got home to Blighty and went to Lincoln Hospital, Lincoln General Hospital, where incidentally I hadn't been there 4 days. No. When I was at Le Trépol, chaps came down from the next stunt. Not Combles, I'll think of the name in a minute, High Street, where the tanks were used the first time. And they came then and said, "We don't know what these things are. Big lumbering things. We never heard about tanks, you know." And they came down, were chap wounded, next bed to me. He said, "Oh, we're all aghast or what thing." He said, "They're all right, provided they're on the move. But once they get stuck, they're there to be hit at."
Where did you go from there then?
Got back to Blighty into Lincoln General Hospital just outside the city. And within 10 days of my getting there, that is to say, within 7 days of their being used for the first time, High Street flares, which I'd been told about when I was at Le Trépol, the Germans were over Lincoln bombing. They found out. Rustin and Holmes, with the agricultural engineers, Didn't do the whole of it, didn't build the whole of the tank, but it was built in different parts. And of course, what better firm than an agricultural engineer could be to do some, be, to do something in the man, in the working producing the, some part of the tank.
Had they been bombing in that area?
They hadn't used the word tank then. Not when I was at the Crapaw. Great monstrous looking things.
How were you treated at Lincoln?
Very well, except that one lady who never came to the ward again.
Could you tell that story, because that wasn't on the tape?
Should I?
Yeah.
Well, in this ward there was a lady from one of the county families who used to come once a week, and she was very rather nosy, wanted to know everything, and went her first visit after I was there, she said I was wounded, because of course she couldn't see any bandages, and I just pointed down under the bed, hoping that'd be sufficient. The next week she came, said, and said, "Where were you wounded?" I knew what she was after. I said, "Well, Guillemont." It wasn't the particular place. I know she wanted to know. It was where the wound actually was, which of course, being under the clothes, she couldn't see. And finally, the next week, she pointed. "Now, where are you wounded? Where were you wounded?" And then, I was a bit fed up with this continuing questioning, and so I said, "Madam, if you've been wounded where I've been wounded, you wouldn't have been wounded at all," which meant that was the last time she visited that ward when I was there. All the rest of the fellows in the ward, of course, they guffawed somewhat loudly after my reply, and she's talked out of the ward not to come back again while I was there.
Did you have any other visitors? Were your parents allowed to visit you or anything?
Yes. No, my parents did not come up to Lincoln, but my aunt. My aunt came down from Leeds, and she'd been an under matron, and so of course she was a maiden lady, and she regarded me as her nephew. Always had. Even got the matron to send me parcels from the hospital where she was under matron, and she took to Olive after we were married. So there we are. But father and mother did not come up to Lincoln. They came to me at Birmingham, my second room.
How long were you at Lincoln?
About 5 weeks, I should think, and then I had convalescence from the hospital and returned to the hospital just at Redcar, you know, just a little break. And then I did have sick leave, and of course came down to Bristol in my blues, which of course attracted a certain amount of attention.
We've fully recovered.
You know what I mean, don't you, about the blues?
Well, you could explain.
Yes, well, it's if you're sick, the RAMC put you in a blue uniform, not khaki.
You said it attracted attention. What sort of attention did it?
Well, everybody knew I'd been wounded. They only had to see that on me. They knew that I was recovering from a wound.
How did they treat you?
Well, the people round about, neighbours. Oh, well, very well.
Were you the returned hero, or pardon? Did they see you as a hero, or was it so commonplace?
Well, I played it down if they did.
What happened next after your sick leave? Where did you go from there?
I was then ordered to report to Hawfield Barracks, which was a big peacetime barracks, not 2 miles from where my parents' home was. And I was there for a time, and that really broke my patriotism. There were people there who fit fellows, and they used to get ourselves who'd been out in France, and all of us were not perfectly fit, and drill us up and down the square. And to think that these people had been there then, you know, for 2 years doing this to us, who'd been out in France and been through the trenches, and they treated us as though we were less than the dust. I was very fed up. I lost a lot of my patriotism there, and when I had the order to report to the Sittingbourne depot where, from where you went to France. I went and saw the adjutant and I said, I still have a bandage on where I was wounded and it's still discharging. Am I to go back to France like that? And he said, oh, I'll see about that. And then, in fact, he marked me, cut me off from the Sittingbourne reinforcement place in Kent to go back to France. And I was down in orders to go to a convalescent camp in Ireland. It was originally had been the in County Cork, Ballyvenair, and that had been a garrison depot, but they got this camp up on the hills at Ballyvenair, not at Buttevant, where the garrison was, and it was Caseman's idea when he landed to be able to say 5,000 British troops captured him. Not one of them had a rifle, but it would have looked very well, and wouldn't very well look for us. But fortunately, he was captured at Mallow before he got that far. But he could have had the whole lot of us. He would only have needed a couple of machine guns and four or five Irish volunteers to have awed us. But we hadn't got a single weapon. There were 5,000. Well, I was there from the December 1916 till May 1970 when I had this letter from Captain Beckett telling me that he thought I ought to apply for a commission.
Before we do that, what duties did you have while you were in the convalescent camp? Did you do?
Well, it was such a big camp that even the regimental sergeant majors had an office, and I was put in charge of that office to do the clerical work for two regimental sergeant majors.
What did that entail?
Looking through the list of NCOs according to their rank and drawing out a list for the RSM to read out at the next parade in the morning who was on what of the NCOs.
So you were setting up the roster, basically?
I set up a daily roster out of the whole strength, which of course varied because people were going, people were coming.
So they weren't very strenuous duties then?
Oh, not there, no. But there were certain duties. They had to be responsible. Someone had to be responsible that the place was kept clean. Someone had to be responsible to see that our fellows didn't go beyond a certain distance from the camp, which was the orders. Otherwise, they reckoned that we should have been picked up and taken to an Irish camp, you know, as prisoner.
Was there much problem with the relationships with the Irish in this? Because it was after the Easter Rising.
Well, this was after the Easter Rising. Some fellows got in with Irish girls, but they were on the whole pretty frosty, and we always had to go out with sidearms and together, never by himself.
Did you experience any hostility from the Irish yourself?
No, I never got in their company, but some did, and others. The Irish, of course, haven't got a lot of money, and doubtless our fellows have got more money, and they were pleased to get what money they could from our chap. Some fellows went to Tipperary, as far away as that, from Cork.
Did you have the feeling that you were an occupying force? Or
not at all. Not at all, no. I mean, I'd been taught geography, and Great Britain and Ireland, it was one thing to me. And what is more, I was interested in politics in my last year at school, and I know that Redmond promised support by the Irish party against the Germans in August 14.
Now, you said you received a letter advising you to try and seek a commission. Could you tell me about that?
Yes, well, you've heard me mention before that the company commander, who was last in charge of number 2 Company, 12th Gloucesters, had been a master at the school I went to. And he wrote and said he thought I ought to apply for a commission. He thought I'd had sufficient experience, though a youngster, because at that time, this was February 17. I was only 20 then.
What qualities did you think made you seem likely to be able to get a commission? Why do you feel that he picked on you, besides knowing you?
He knew I was being fairly smart on parade, because we had a cadet corps, and he knew what I'd been in the 12th Gloucesters, both in his company and then as the colonel's runner. And
because you hadn't been picked out as an NCO,
No, I stuck together with my friend Harold Howell and Tom Webber. And so it was a great upset to me when I was parted from them to go and be the colonel's runner, although that was nothing to my shame.
What did you do then after you received this letter advising you to seek a commission? What steps
I wrote
to
the War Office and applied for one.
And what did you put in your letter to make them think you were worthy of it?
Well, I said that if they wished for confirmation of this, my company commander in the 12th Gloucesters in the 5th Division in France, they could write to him, see what he said.
And what happened then? What, could you take me how you got your stages?
Yes,
you your commission?
I heard I had after a time, perhaps a couple of months, and I was running this little Sergeant Major's orderly room. I had a little bit of an authority I never had before, and I got a notification to report to the Household Brigade Officer Cadet Battalion, which was in a big hotel with its own golf course just outside London, which I did.
Besides being separated from your friends, what had changed your mind about becoming an officer?
Well, in the fact that my situation financially wasn't theirs. Each of them was a clerical employee in one or other of the big firms, Wills or the British American Tobacco Company, and that firm was so strong and patriotic that they made up their wages above the army pay. I had no such firm.
This is your two friends of the Bristols, and you decided, were you thinking of making a career in the army, or were you?
No, because even then we thought the war wouldn't be long over. Although I had friends in the sixth form with me who took the first, second and third places for Sanders, of course for permanent commissions.
What happened when you got to the Household Cadet Battalion?
Well, of course I was a little different from everybody, because most of them were in civilian's clothes, having come out either from the public schools, the top notch public schools, or the diplomatic service, or big noises in the city. And it was rather amusing to see someone who was probably the head of a company of a million capital, having to do ordinary private's work in what would be West End clothes. But whereas I was then still, I was in khaki, and of course I'd got a wound stripe up and this Lance Corporal stripe, from being in charge of the Sergeant Major's orderly room.
They made you a Lance Corporal then, had they?
No, they made me a Lance Corporal over in Ireland. But I came there, one of the youngsters. I was only about the same age as some of them were coming out of the public schools.
What training were you given towards becoming an officer then?
Very strict. It was in two parts, and during the time I was there, there was a changeover in instructor NCOs and warrant officers. And the second lot of warrant officers, they, from the different guards regiment, said, we'll soon whip these people into pace. I don't know what's happened to them before. And on one morning, we had a new RSM, and we stood to attention and stood at ease 32 times before he was satisfied, before breakfast. The adjutant got fed up. He went to his breakfast.
So you were put through basic drill again,
Yes, 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 right to the bottom. Just the same as though we were on, I can't think of the word now, you know, new soldiers parade.
Were you given instruction in how to give orders and what orders to give?
Oh, yes, we took our turn in being platoon commander. And one of the fellows in the room with me, quite remarkable, there was two Scotsmen, two English and one Welshman, and he was very strong Welsh, you could tell by his accent, and it's one of the things that will remain in my memory all my life. We had the second half of the people came in, and he said, "Are you Welsh?" He said, "Yes." He started off in Welsh. Really, it affects me now to see those two fellas talking together in Welsh. The man who'd been with me in the same room, he finished up by being Professor of Celtic Welsh in the University of Wales. And what is more, he was very brainy. They had him out when the commanding officer of the Brigade of Guard came and paid his usual course visit to see how people were getting on. And it was battalion parade. And they put on a man who married lady. Anyway, he became Minister of War, because he was a big noise even then for what he was, Duff Cooper, they brought out Lewis, I think it was, the Welshman, and Duff Cooper to drill the battalion, you know, in battalion drill, which was really only what an adjutant or a colonel could do, with four companies doing movements on parade. And they had the company sergeant major stood near Duff Cooper and kept on whispering to him. He whispered the wrong words of command, and Lewis said no, and he said stand fast, about turn, march to your places now, you will do this, not in front of the GOC. And he was only a language professor.
Was everybody in this battalion an officer candidate?
Hoped to become.
That's what the battalion was for?
That was for, yes. Many didn't pass the first half and went back to units as whatever they were.
What else were you taught besides drill and drill commands?
Military law.
What did that entail? What were you
well, doing? The minor things to deal with court-martials and the Hanfield's court-martial number one. And
was that done by lectures or just...
Yes, reading? Lectures, yes. And I do remember this, that I got marked down to one answer that I gave, and I said, immediately after, I said, this isn't wrong, this was right. And I stood up, and when the commandant had us all out going over each one's papers in front of all the rest, I said, I'm sorry, sir, I cannot agree with your comment on my answer that. I think that what I wrote down is the correct one. He said, sit down.
What other training were you given then?
We did a lot of soldiers' work, bayonet imitation bayonet fighting, and then we did commanding work, which a subaltern would do in marching a platoon up about the place. You know.
What about tactics? Were you given any insight into the tactics that you might be employing?
Yes, minor tactics. Really, as a subaltern, you really only told what your company commander said what he wanted done, or what the battalion commander, or even what brigade said you wanted done. You hadn't been out in France again, you didn't have much freedom of movement. Unless you were out on your own, then you could do what you like, nobody would say boo to you.
Were you taught any of the sophistications of trench warfare, how they were affecting the work of an officer. Did you, was that taken
into
account?
No, but of course, I won in perhaps 250, I'd been through it.
But what about the others? How would they be taught how to set
sentry duties? They'd be very raw when they got out of France.
So you weren't taught things like sentry duty rotors, that sort of thing?
Well, we did a certain amount of sentry duty, yes, as privates in the platoons of this cadet corps. So you knew what to do. Then you took your turn doing duties like that. You took your turn doing commanding duties, like in charge of a platoon.
How were you assessed at the end of the first half when they sent?
Well, one by a written exam, which I took a second place, and another by on parade. I remember my own platoon commander after the first exam. He said, "You may be very good on Hayward paper. You may be very good on paper, Hayward. You're not damn good on parade." My word, I put myself into it. I thought, am I going to be turned down from getting a commission because I wasn't? So I used to go for those sacks with my bayonet, you know.
Was there any sort of tutor? Were you assigned to any one officer within the battalion who would take an interest in your progress?
No, there weren't. All we had was one officer per platoon of about 35.
Would he give you any help overcoming any problems you'd have?
If you felt you were not certain, he was the one you would go to ask.
And he'd tell you what was right and what was wrong?
Yes. If it was certain thing that only a commissioned officer in that rank knew the answer, you could go and ask him.
Were you trained at all in things like mess traditions and how to behave in the mess, the sort of pomp and ceremony of
ours? Well, apart from regimental, I mean, these people from the Foreign Office or from the public school didn't need to be taught that. Perhaps I wasn't quite so au fait with the niceties of dinner then, but we lived as privates, and I'd been a prefect at school, and I'd sat on the high table with the headmaster and his wife. So what my parents hadn't told me, keeping my eyes open, I knew what was the thing to do, and that the bowl of water on the side wasn't something to drink out of, but to dip your fingers in.
At the end of the second period, how were you assessed at the end of the second period of training?
Well, then it rather moved over more from your proficiency as a soldier, private, to your ability to give commands. And having been in a written paper given a certain situation, what to do, you had to say what you thought should be done by you in those particular circumstances.
And how did you do at that?
On paper.
In both of them, both the giving the commands and the written exam.
Well, a situation was set up. Now give you commands to deal with this.
And you found no difficulty in that?
No, very good training we had. But after all, and that was built on what I'd seen out in France, the 12 clusters.